Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Hi, everybody. Hello again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Shartok. Joining us today is Dr. John Mastrangelo. He's chief of radiology at Nathan Litauer Hospital, practices at the hospital's Millennium Medical Imaging in Gloversville, where nobody goes barehanded. Dr. Mastrangelo earned his medical degree from Albany Medical College, completed his residency in radiology at Albany Medical Center. He's certified by the American Board of Radiology. Do you have a question for him? Give us a call at 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Or you can just, if things get really hot, which I know they're gonna, then you all you do is come in on the Vox Pop at WAMC.org, and we'll get your message and we'll try to get to it. So, Dr. John, tell me about whether you glow in the dark. Do you?
Well, not yet. We try to use pretty good protections when we're working, you know, in the field with different imaging modalities, whether it's fluoroscopy, X-rays, or CT, and, you know, try to keep that uniform throughout our department, not only for us, the physicians, but also our technologists who are involved in the studies as well.
So sometimes when they want you to do an MRI, they want to inject you with the stuff, with the ink or whatever it is. Is that a good idea? Can it hurt you?
Yeah, I mean, it can. Certainly there are risks to getting an injection.
Yep.
Sort of just like taking penicillin or aspirin or any sort of medication.
Yep.
It's kind of considered the same thing. Sometimes you really need the injection to look for certain types of disease and pathology, whereas other times you don't need it. So if it's something that can be determined, the clinical question can be answered, and we don't need to give the injection, then it's best not to give it, and usually we'll talk to your doctor and make sure that's okay.
I always say no. Mm-hmm. So the next question is, you know, what are the major advances? The Brits are now, I was listening to BBC this morning, and, you know, there are all kinds of new things that are coming up that where we couldn't see before because of some of these organs were hidden, and now we can find them because of blood tests and other things.
It's really incredible, actually, and in my field, radiology in particular, really seems to be advancing at quite a rapid rate, not only with new technologies that haven't even really been around before, but the technologies that have been around for 10, 20, 30 years keep on getting better. For example, MRIs, which before had very low magnetic field strengths, the magnetic field strengths keep on getting greater and greater. There are 7 Tesla experimental magnets. Most are only 1.5 in the field. And you can see things that were too small to see before, and you can see things that are at a much higher resolution than previously. So certainly you can make more diagnoses that you couldn't make before.
And you read them yourself?
We do, yes.
So somebody comes in, if I come in and you do one on me, say, well, doc, what'd you see? You're going to say your doctor will have to tell you, right?
Well, that's one of the things that, you know, I really enjoy doing is talking to patients whenever possible. And if they have particular questions, I'm all for going over their studies with them myself.
Yeah, so if they say to you, hey, doc, you can just tell me, did you see a tumor there? And you're going to tell them?
I've had that conversation before.
No kidding.
Yeah.
You're a good man. Okay, we're going to Michelle in Albany. All right, Michelle, you're on. Whoa, Michelle got off. Too late. She didn't have the patience she needed. Jim from Matamoros. Okay, Jim, welcome back. What do you got?
How much greater tissue penetration do you get with cobalt therapy over deep radiation therapy?
You know, Jim, that's a good question. It's something that really the radiation oncologists deal with. They're even more super specialized than I am, and they deal with the treatment of different sorts of ionizing radiation therapy, not just cobalt like you're talking about, but also different forms of iodine and fluorine and all these other different kinds of substances. Cobalt is a deep penetrator. It's not something I really work with. I'm pretty sure it's a gamma ray emitter, and it does penetrate deeply, but in comparison to other substances, I sort of would have to know what those substances are and how long you're intending on being treated for.
So what is cobalt?
It's on that periodic table. It's an element, yeah. And there are different forms of cobalt, just like there are different forms of carbon in our atmosphere and different forms of plutonium and cesium. And some of the forms are radioactive. They emit energies, which can cause a tumor.
Uh-huh.
Also, so some of these materials have been studied, and there are medical uses for some of them that we utilize today in terms of treatment for certain therapies, in terms of implants to give us local effects for therapy, and that continues to change and evolve.
1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in right now are 100%. 1-800-348-2551. When you go to, for example, your colleague who I really love, Dr. Shin, and who really worked on my back, and they're not going to do anything, are they, without getting an MRI first or taking a look at what's going on in your body?
Certainly the MRI is an important part of the decision-making process and determining what to do next, but a lot of the information really comes from a really good history and physical. You know, it's
sure.
Sort of talked about in med school and taught that, you know, 90% of the diagnoses that you can make are done with a history and physical and that sort of information. So in combination with that and with the MRI that you do to sort of see what levels are the most affected and if that corresponds with the physical exam that was performed in the office, then we can sort of come up with a plan together to figure out, is this something that needs surgery? Is this something that needs a steroid injection to see if it works? See if that's the level that's causing the pain. There's a whole bunch of people that are involved in the care of back pain and figuring out the treatment for it.
So let's say Dr. Shen, my hero, has somebody approaches him. He's going to take a look at you, John, and say, well, what do you think? Because, you know, it's always good to have a shared responsibility, right?
Absolutely. You know, it's something we work together as a team, and it happens all the time where they get imaging, and sometimes they even have to do repeat imaging after surgery to see how things look and how the surgery went and make sure that things are going to be positive going forward.
Let's talk to Mark in Salem. Mark, you're on.
Hello, doctors. My mother, who's in her early 80s, had colon cancer surgery last October, and we elected not to do chemo because of her general health. She's had two PET scans since then. She had what they call stage 3. Two lymph nodes were involved. One was slightly metastasized, and the other one was still encapsulated. And the PET scans have come back negative, and she still has concern that this cancer is going to return, you know, in the next a little bit, and like how often someone like her should have one, and what is the recidivism? I know that the difference on the chart that the doctor gave me was like a 3% whether you had chemo or not at her age.
That's a good question, Mark. I hope you don't mind my interrupting. I'm trying to get everybody in here.
Sure.
So, Doc, what do you hear? What do you think?
Yeah, so the PET CTs and PET scans are something that we deal with all the time, and I think it's a really, really powerful tool that your doctor can utilize to help look for any metastatic disease from the original cancer.
What is a PET scan?
So a PET scan is it's an exam that's performed in nuclear medicine, and usually it utilizes something called FDG, which is a form of glucose metabolism. And the thought is that tumor cells utilize glucose for their fuel, and so the substance that's being injected into your body is a form of glucose that the camera that we utilize picks up, and we can see spots that are otherwise might not be easy to see with a normal CT scan. Usually the PET scan is fused with a low-dose CT for anatomic imaging. So say you can see something in the abdomen as a big bright spot, you compare it with a CT scan, okay, now you know that spot is definitively within the liver and not next to the liver or next to it. Mm-hmm. But getting back to the question about the colon cancer and the metastatic disease, I think that it's a good idea to follow up with the doctor's advice and do the PET scans at screening intervals. cycles. Everybody's a little different. Sometimes 6 months, sometimes less, sometimes longer, sometimes a year. The other thing that they might consider is getting a MRI of the liver if she's a candidate for that, because oftentimes that's one of the first places that you might see a lesion, and sometimes on PET that might be obscured because the liver does have some uptake of the glucose metabolism. So those two tests combined are something that we see fairly frequently in surveillance for somebody who has had colon cancer. And that's something to think about and go forward. I think it's a very useful, powerful tool, and I strongly support it.
Mark, thank you very much. Okay, let's go to a break. We'll go to a break, and we'll come right back.
Support comes from Ellis Medicine, providing inpatient and outpatient care for New York's Capital Region. Reinventing healthcare one patient at a time, ellismedicine.org. The Clark Art Institute in Williamstown, Massachusetts, currently presenting the exhibitions Van Gogh and Nature and Whistler's Mother, Gray, Black, and White, clarkart.edu. Health Psychology Associates, Albany, New York, providing a spectrum of psychological services including individual and family counseling, ADHD testing, multicultural counseling, treatment for eating disorders, and more, albanyhpa.com. The Honest Wheat Food Co-op, 100 Waterbury Avenue in Albany, New York, specializing in local and organic produce, natural groceries, fine cheeses, locally raised meats, and ready-to-go organic meals, honestweight.coop. Planned Parenthood, Mid-Hudson Valley, providing sexual and reproductive health and education services in Dutchess, Orange, Ulster, and Sullivan counties for over 80 years, ppmhv.org. And from the Lathrop Communities, serving older adults in the Quaker tradition for 25 years, independent living in Northampton and Easthampton, Massachusetts, in the heart of the Pioneer Valley, lathrop.kendall.org.
Hello, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Mastrangelo, Chief of Radiology at Nathan Litauer Hospital and a member of the Millennium Medical Imaging Group in Gloversville. Okay, we'll go to Ellen in Buckland, Massachusetts. By the way, folks, your chances of getting in now are excellent. 1-800-348-2551. Okay, Ellen, you're on.
Okay, which would you choose to do for someone who's had a concussion, didn't know she had a concussion until she had blurred vision about 10 days after a fall going very fast on a mountain bike? She developed the blurred vision. Would you do an MRI or a CAT scan, or how would you proceed?
It's something that is sort of depends on what sort of symptoms are currently going on. If it's a one-time thing, oftentimes all of the imaging studies are going to be negative. Because the CT scan gives off radiation and is a little bit less sensitive, meaning that you might not see things on the CT scan that you might see with an MRI, I would lean towards, if I had to choose between the two, I think an MRI might offer a little bit better imaging choice in that circumstance. Or alternatively, not doing any imaging at all, and as long as the symptoms resolve, that's probably all that's necessary.
No. When you refer to caller Ellen, is that you or is that somebody?
My daughter,
else?
My 34-year-old daughter.
Okay, gotcha. That's a good answer, I guess. Anything else, Ellen?
Well, so the symptoms resolved. Can she go back to the same heavy-duty mountain biking?
Yeah, typically it's something that she needs to really talk about with a neurologist or her primary care doctor that really specializes more in this sort of thing. But in terms of the imaging of a concussion, the most common things that we see in that scenario is a negative exam.
Right.
And so, in the scenario where that you're stating and there's blurred vision and stuff, the real danger is, well, does this continue to happen? Mm-hmm. And so maybe it's not just a concussion. Maybe there's something else going on. And that often leads them to the imaging department where we do the MRI and hopefully still the test is negative. But I've seen cases where they think it's a concussion and it can be something else.
Well, let me just say,
like a tumor?
It can be anything. I mean, it could be a tumor. It could just be that somebody had an old bleed. There's lots of things that can cause it. But typically it's a negative study. So,
yeah. Okay. Ellen, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. One last thing, and that is tell her to stay off the bike. Okay. That's Alan talking, not Dr. Jung. Okay. Let's go to Kristen in New Paltz. Okay. Kristen, you're on.
Hi there. I have a concern about my five-month-old granddaughter who had a concussion and was admitted to the PICU, and they did one CAT scan, but 3 days later she was still in the hospital and fairly unresponsive, so they did another one. This is now 3.5 years later, and she's developmentally fine, but I'm frightened about the long-term effects of those two CAT scans.
This is something that I think is always coming up more and more with the news talking about radiation risks. And I think certainly you have a concern to say, you know, my five-month-old daughter got some CAT scans. In the world of radiology, we use a principle called ELERA, which is as low as reasonably achievable to image people. And it doesn't really matter how many CT scans somebody might get. The most important thing is that you make a diagnosis. So in your daughter's case, it sounds like they were concerned that there might be something going on in the brain. So they need to do a CAT scan to make sure there was no bleed, no tumor. I think those things are incredibly important to make sure and rule those causes out. In terms of the long-term sequela of two CAT scans, it's very, very extremely low in terms of risk. The brain is very radio insensitive. It's one of the most insensitive organs in our body to the effects of radiation. So I think going forward, it's a good idea to try to limit radiation. But if somebody gets into an accident and they need to get a CAT scan, they need to, I'd say it's important that the doctors have that imaging tool at their disposal to help them with their scenario. But I wouldn't be too concerned about the long-term effects of those two exams.
Well, I have dreaded making this phone call for the last 3 years, and I'm feeling a whole lot better.
Yeah, I would be positive about the whole thing if I were you. Sounds like hopefully she's doing okay.
Thanks, Kristen. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah, bye.
Okay, let's go to Curran in Latham, where everybody goes around in circles. Okay, Curran, you're on.
Hi. I was applying for a job out in Korea, and when I was sent off to the doctor, and I stood in front of a wall, and then they showed me a scan of my chest before I got the job. I was wondering what kind of scan that was. Is that safe? And why would they do that to everyone?
Sure. A lot of places do a pre-employment chest x-ray to make sure that there's nothing serious going on, that there's no tuberculosis, that there's no big risk factor sort of going forward as a screening tool. It's a very low-dose exam. It's very commonly performed. And it's not uncommon to have people have a pre-employment chest x-ray to look for that kind of stuff.
And for all of us who have had many, many chest x-rays in our life, when is it too much?
You know, I don't know if it's ever too much in the right situation. Some people with heart failure or lung cancer, they can have hundreds of chest x-rays.
Right.
And probably one chest CT is the equivalent of about 30, 40, 50
really?
Chest x-rays. So if you have 100 chest x-rays, that's almost like getting two chest CTs, which is not a terribly huge amount of radiation,
okay,
especially if it's spread over many years.
Okay, so then how many chest CTs is too much?
That's a great question. It really, once again, it kind of depends on the clinical scenario. It's not uncommon for people in their lifetime to have 10 or 12 chest CTs in the, you know, if they have something going on that needs to be treated.
Sure. Are you okay, Karen?
I was just wondering, that was in Korea. Do they also do that for pre-employment in America too?
They do it in America at a lot of places, and I'm not sure what the practices are in Korea.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks, Karen. Bye-bye. Let's go to Dick. No, that's a mess. I messed up. See, it says 1 and 1, Joe Mekowitz. Okay, say, hey, Joe, number 1 and 2 are both 1. So I don't know what the second one is. We just did number 1. Now what's number 2? Oh, no, that's number 3. See? Don't you see? This is very confusing. Is it number 1? Number 1. Okay, okay, now we're getting a clarification from the Board of Elections here. And any second now, we're going to see what that clarification says. I'm sitting here with bated breath. Well, okay, we're going to go in the meantime to number 5. And number 5 is Rex in Pittsfield. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon, doctors.
Yep.
I got a question about CT CAT scan contrast, the dye that they use.
Yep.
I recently was in the hospital, and they gave me a CT scan, and next thing I know, I'm in the hospital for 2 weeks because the CAT scan contrast has cooked my kidneys.
Aye, aye, aye.
And I went in for a minor infection and ended up spending 2 weeks in the hospital. Is this something that happens very often, or was I just one of the lucky ones?
It sounds like you're one of the unfortunate few that have a really serious issue with the contrast dye. As I said before, it's like giving a medication just like anything else. Some people have really serious penicillin allergies. Some have serious peanut allergies even. And some few people have a very serious reaction to the dye. Usually that if you have a really severe reaction, that can result in something like anaphylactic shock or poor renal function like you experienced. It's something, you know, in the future, if you're having a CAT scan, I would encourage, if possible, to do it without contrast. But some things that they need to give contrast for, some places have a protocol in place where you take multiple doses of steroids and other medications to sort of limit your risk of radiation. But something to sort of think about going forward is, are there other imaging modalities, if your doctor needs to look at something, that can be used, such as MRI or ultrasound instead?
Right.
Yeah,
I'm just curious. I had several CAT scans before this and never had a problem.
Right. It's just like somebody who's had shellfish for, right, you know, many years of their life, and all of a sudden they have that one lobster tail and they go into, they get that reaction. Yeah.
But I think Nancy Reagan had it right. Just say no. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
All right, Alan. Thank you very much. John. Bye.
You're welcome. Great question.
And we'll go to Dick in Long Meadow. Dick, are you there?
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have just a couple of questions. A lot of the hospitals in our area are advertising a thing that they have called stereotactic radiation. And I was wondering if you could comment about and define what that is. And the second question is, how can it benefit patients?
So in terms of stereotactic radiation, I assume that you're talking about like radiation therapy, something radiation. Once again, that's sort of something that a radiation oncologist, which is a sort of subset of oncologists that deal with radiotherapy, which is a very specialized field that we don't necessarily deal with too much in my field in radiology. But I'm familiar with the term, and basically the stereotactic component of that is that they use imaging guidance to sort of really hone in where you're getting the treatment, to sort of minimize the exposure of the other areas that they don't want to treat with the radiation, because that local therapy is going to kill the tissue and hopefully kill that tumor or whatever it is that they're trying to radiate. And you want to spare the remainder of the normal tissue as much as possible. And that stereotactic approach and that technology, that helps with that.
Now, some surgeons, right, use radiology as they are going.
Absolutely.
To see what's going on. Is that what you're talking about, or is this a little bit different?
It's very similar. It's very similar, and certainly certain neurosurgeries are done with MRI guidance today, and CT guidance, and nose, ears, nose, and throat surgery. They have imaging guidance. There's all sorts of different technologies out there which incorporate our imaging studies into sort of providing a roadmap or a guideline for where the surgeons are going to perform their surgeries.
So, Dick, okay?
Okay, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. Thanks. Have
Bye.
A good day.
Yep. And we'll go to Colin in Springfield. 1-800-348-2551. Colin, you're on.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Hello.
Alan, good segue. I work in an operating room, and I have two quick questions. One, we use a lot of fluoroscopy, and a couple years back, one of the technologists who comes in and operates the machine had commented to me about a six-foot rule with scatter and radiation. I just want to ask the doctor if that was or what his opinions were about that. And also, we have to wear radiation badges, as he's well aware. Where would he put his control badge within the operating room or locker or whatnot to make things as accurate as possible?
Yeah, so these are phenomenal questions, and something that we deal with every day. And most places have a radiation safety protocol in place where everybody has a badge. You wear it in a certain location, and some places are different depending on what their, you know, their program is. And they monitor the technologists. They monitor the physicians that are doing the fluoroscopy for a radiation dose. And once they do their checks and they find that somebody is over the allotment, they either tone down how often they are able to spend time in the OR suite with fluoroscopy, or they sort of figure out, well, why is that badge registering a high amount? Sometimes it's as simple as the badge was left on the floor in the operating room, so even though the person wasn't actually physically present, that badge was still registering the radiation. Going back to that first part of your question, it's a very, very important principle in terms of fluoroscopy in particular, which I utilize almost every day of my practice. And that is, the farther away you stay from the emitter of the radiation, the less and less dose that you're going to receive to your body. So if I'm operating the camera, which I often have to stand next or very close proximity to where the x-rays are coming out of to do an injection, I try to stay at least 3 feet away. 6 feet away would be even better, and it's an exponential decline in the amount of radiation that you get for every 3 feet, every more distance you put between yourself and the camera. If you have the ability to wear lead, you should always wear lead when you're, you know, in the OR suite with the fluoroscopy. And if you can stand behind the doctor even, or in front of somebody else who has another lead apron on, that even provides you more protection.
Now that you're on that question, for all of us who went to the dentist and are old enough not to have had the lead apron put on us,
sure,
and then later on in life to start getting the lead apron, is there any stats as to whether or not that was dangerous?
I don't know if there's any really statistics out there. Even the statistics that they have that deal with radiation damage and the long-term effects of radiation are really not, it's not really good data. A lot of that is all developed based off of the atomic bomb and the Hiroshima survivors. And the amount and type of radiation that was used during those explosions is not what we use in our medical field today. So they try to make these assumptions and extrapolate what the risks are, but overall, I'm not sure that the data is great. But it's certainly out there and reasonable to say that as low as reasonably achievable. You know, the ALERA principle: you try to do the imaging, try to make the diagnosis with the least amount of radiation possible.
And now, one last question about I think it was Colin who just asked about fluoroscopy, right?
Yeah.
Now, fluoroscopy was fairly early, right,
mm-hmm.
compared to the rest of it. What is it?
So fluoroscopy is like a real-time x-ray that there's a camera and you provide radiation and you can see in real time sort of what something looks like with an x-ray beam. It's a little bit lower dose than an actual exposure. Like if you were to go get a chest x-ray, a two-view chest x-ray, and they take actual exposures, the fluoroscopy exposures are a little bit less radio-intensive. But some procedures take minutes and minutes and minutes of fluoroscopy time. So if you're in one of those procedures, you might have 20 minutes of fluoroscopy time, which the total dose of that radiation would be much greater than a simple two-view chest x-ray.
Of course. Well, thank you very much, Colin. Appreciate your
call. Thank you, guys.
Yep. Got lots of phones open right now for some strange reason. So I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll take an unusual timeout, and then we will be right back. And so if you're there, Angela in Chicago, stay there. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Nathan LaTower Hospital, Gloversville, New York, less than 50 minutes from Albany, offering minimally invasive procedures for back pain with Dr. Ja'an Shen, NLH.org, for more information. Shedman Custom Woodworks, featuring a variety of sized sheds, gazebos, and garages with site work, installation, and delivery in New Lebanon and Brunswick, New York. Shedman.com for inventory. Carrie Haddad Gallery, Hudson, New York, presenting Abstraction, an exhibit of paintings, photographs, and sculpture through August 23rd. Open daily 11 to 5. CarrieHaddadGallery.com. Poughkeepsie Farm Project, hosting the Summer Institute for Educators, using school gardens to teach August 18th through 21st. FarmProject.org for registration. New York's Ensemble for the Romantic Century, returning to the Berkshires with Van Gogh's Ear, an original theatrical concert complementing the Clark's Van Gogh exhibit, August 20th through 30th. RomanticCentury.org for tickets. and from NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com.
And we are back with Dr. John Mastrangelo of Nathan Littauer, radiologist and a guy who really knows his stuff and has been explaining it to all of us today. Let's go to Angela in Chicago. Are you really in Chicago, Angela?
Hello.
Are you really?
Hi.
Are you really in Chicago right now?
Well, I'm actually on the move to Boston, so I don't know what city I'm in. So
yeah,
okay. I just said Chicago is where I'm from.
Go ahead. What do you want to know?
I just wanted to ask the doctor what the most unexpected or strangest thing he saw in one of the images of one of his patients.
Did you ever see a scissors or a hammer?
Sure, that's probably along those lines. There's certainly lots of different utensils and foreign objects that sort of find their way into patients. That's probably one of the most unusual things that we see from time to time.
Okay.
But Angela wanted to know the most strange thing you ever saw.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You know, sometimes the most unexpected things sometimes are the saddest ones, where somebody comes in and they think that, you know, they're pregnant, and in fact they have a huge tumor in their belly.
Yeah, yeah.
Or even more unfortunate, you know, it's something else. But also sometimes there's a good surprise. So I remember one time somebody thought that they had a tumor in their stomach, and it was actually a big hairball that was in there. So it had to be removed.
What were you thinking of, Angela?
I was thinking probably a fork or something. Yeah, like you said, utensils.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, thank you so much for your call. Great call.
Thank you.
Yep. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Richard in Queensbury, where everybody plays by the rules. Richard, you're on.
Hi. I was wondering if neutron radiography is ever used in medical exams.
I'm not familiar with it ever being used.
What is it?
I'm not familiar with the term.
What's the term?
Neutrons instead of x-rays or radio waves.
Okay, well, I think you've stumped the band. Thank you. Thanks very much. Appreciate it. Okay, let's go to Jeff in Gloversville. Okay, Jeff in Gloversville, where nobody goes barehanded. Go ahead, Jeff.
Hi, Dr. Mastrangelo. I just I wondered, there's a lot of information out there about MRIs now and quiet MRIs and open MRIs and closed-bore MRIs, and I just wondered, how does a patient determine what's best for them and where they should go?
You know, that's a great question, Jeff. It's one of those things that most of the time patients come to an imaging center and they don't really know what's best, and they don't really have any idea. And sort of one of the things that we really try at Nathan Littauer and wherever I practice is to try to provide them with such a very high quality imaging study. And that involves a lot of things, whether it's providing equipment that is up to date and state of the art so that you can have a great imaging quality exam, something that is fast. So the better the equipment, oftentimes the faster the scan, so you don't have to lie so long in an uncomfortable position. Or if you have to have a silent scan, say you have headaches or migraines, you have the technology. Some magnets have the ability to become more quiet during certain parts of the exam, which is helpful. And that's something that we try to utilize when we do our exams at Nathan Littauer.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
You're welcome. Thanks.
You know, the radiologist always says, don't move. You know, that's impossible.
It so is. I've had some myself, so I know what that's like.
Right. Let's go to, we already did Jeff. So let's go to Jackie in Troy. All right, Jackie in Troy, you're on.
Oh, hi, and thank you for taking my call today.
Sure.
I had a question dealing with children and mainly this infant in radiology, and I'll give you my background. I have a grandson that's only 3 months old. He had a ton of projectile vomiting, and he has since had an ultrasound to rule out pyloric stenosis or malrotation, and he still was having this problem, and then he ended up getting like an upper GI. So my questions to you, doctor, are could something still be wrong? Could something like a pyloric stenosis still develop at this point? And then is there any radiation that he's getting at this young age?
So that's a really common clinical scenario, and it's a great question. And that's fairly typical to have start off with an ultrasound to look for something like that, and then to proceed with an upper GI scan or vice versa. Start off with a X-ray and then a upper GI study and then an ultrasound. In whatever way, those tests are all sort of used in conjunction with one another to try to figure out what's causing the vomiting. The effects, the amount of radiation that you get from those studies, especially if you only had one upper GI series and one X-ray and an ultrasound, is extremely, extremely low, and I would not be worried about the effects on my infant.
Now, in the old days, Doc, when we had these procedures done, I remember my father doing it, complaining about it, having to drink chalk.
Yeah.
And then doing scans. Seems to me there's less chalk around these days. Am I right?
I think there is. You know, back in the day, there were, before even I practiced, there was a lot more, and that chalk was a barium, which you have people swallow, and so we can see it on the X-ray. And they still use it today, and we still do it today. Whereas before, though, an imaging center might perform 30 of those kinds of studies a day. We might do 3 or 4 today. And part of that is because there are so many other imaging modalities like CT, like MRI, which see things at a much higher resolution than those studies did back then.
So why do they use it?
So now it's used for a lot of dynamic things, like for esophageal reflux, for ulcers. There are still things that tool does better than CTs or MRI does. And for those patients that they're looking for that, we still go back to the older modality and the older tool because sometimes that's just still better.
So who makes the decision? Is it you or is it, for example, Dr. Shen? Who would make the decision which kind of radiological procedure you would use?
Yeah, typically it's the referring doctor. In your example, Dr. Shen would order an imaging study and then it would be performed and then I would interpret it. Although when we screen the exams to say, hey, you're looking for this and you ordered this, if we see something that doesn't really match up or we might think there's a better solution, then typically we'll try to call the referring doctor and let them know, hey, if you're looking for this, you might want to consider doing this kind of test, and we can go from there. And sometimes we'll have that conversation, and they might change the order.
Does it always go well, or does anybody ever say, you young whippersnapper, what do you think you are?
Most of the time, everybody's pretty receptive, yeah.
Okay, Jackie, anything else?
I guess my only other question would be is if this is rather common, and that's, I'm glad to hear that it is, from maybe what you've seen, how long will this go on for, or... Is it something that you said with infants? Is it something he could probably outgrow?
So oftentimes, vomiting is something that is outgrown. But it's important to sort of determine what the cause is. If it's just overfeeding and that's kind of how they are and they're just eating too fast, that's obviously the least serious sort of cause of it. But it's very important to sort of keep an eye on things. You have to know, is the vomiting bilious or is it not bilious? That's one of the most important things. If there's green stuff coming up with the vomit, that implies a slightly more serious issue. And that's when you usually get into those sorts of tests where they need to look again. They might have to do another upper GI series to really figure out what's going on.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Right. Thank you.
We're sort of running out of time now. So, Doc, if it's okay with you, we'll go as fast as we possibly can.
I'll try my best.
Okay, no, you're terrific. Let's go to Matt in Malta. M&M, that's alliteration. That's what they teach in English class. Go ahead, Matt.
Hi. I was diagnosed with cancer last year. And, I've been treated, and I currently receive CT scans every 3 months. And... I'm a construction worker, and I'm kind of thinking of getting out of the trade and trying to do something else. And I was thinking something like X-ray tech or MRI or CT scan even, and I was just wondering if that's a wise decision.
Yeah, I think, well, hopefully everything's okay with your cancer and things are going okay. In terms of the X-ray tech, CT tech, that's something that I think it's really fun to do. You know, you get to interact with a lot of people and really play an important role in their healthcare. So if that's something that you're interested in, certainly, definitely, I encourage you to look into it. I think you get paid fairly well and really have a really good impact on people's lives.
And are there jobs out there?
There are. You're always, there's nothing more valuable than a really good technologist to help us do our job.
Matt, thank you very much. Okay, let's go to Mark. Mark, you're on.
Hi, doctor. Question for you. I had a crushed disc, and I had to have my they had to use bone marrow and my own stem cell and a titanium rod in my neck, in place of my disc. And it's a relatively new procedure, but not that new. And I used to get an MRI every year when I went to see the surgeon, and he stopped. And I was wondering if that had anything to do with the amount of radiation that an MRI produces over time. It's been 5 years. So is there a maximum? Could that be possibly why I'm not getting one every year?
Yeah, every case is a little different, but just so you know, it's probably not related to the radiation because MRI doesn't give off any radiation. It's one of those modalities that has no radiation risk. So it's probably because he's satisfied with the results of the prior MRIs. He doesn't feel the need to check it again. That's my guess, but like I said, every case is different, but I wouldn't worry about the radiation.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Okay, let's go to Ashley in Del Mar. Ashley, you're on.
Hi there. So I was just wondering about how common is it for people to experience anxiety in certain imaging machines? So, for example, I had an MRI a couple of years ago and had no prior experience with it and had a complete panic attack, which has never happened to me before. And I just wondered, is this something that typically happens to people, and how can you deal with it? Like if I have to get another MRI, I'm not sure how I would.
Don't feel bad at all. I mean, that happens. It happens fairly commonly. You know, it's anxious just to, you know, it's anxiety provoking experience just to go to the doctor sometimes and go to a test and not really know what's going to happen. One of the things that we recommend is to talk to the doctor that's sending you to the imaging center and take a Valium or one of those kinds of medicines to sort of calm your nerves beforehand, if you're eligible, you know, to take some medicine like that with your doctor's clearance, you know?
Yeah. Right. Well, that's a good answer. Actually, all I got to tell you is I fall asleep there. They have to wake me up. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's go to Maria in Northampton. Okay, Maria in Northampton, you're on.
Hi. Thank you very much. I've had a number of MRIs, and I'm wondering if you could explain why why the hammering sound and why is it in different patterns?
Sure.
And sometimes for long periods and sometimes for short.
It's a common question. It's not something that I am an absolute expert in, but what my understanding of that is that it's the magnet itself. They have different sorts of magnets within the machine, and they're gradients that shift and have to sort of different coils that work together. And it's when those mechanisms are actually changing and moving to help create the image, that's what you're actually hearing, the actual machinery and the magnet working.
Doctor, you talk to the people who are in the machine. Can they talk to you?
Our technologists talk to them. I'm not actually physically there when the scan is going on, but they do talk. There's usually a two-way system to be able to talk back and forth.
Has anybody ever gotten married as a result of that? Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Right. Okay, let's go to Marie. The last one was Maria. Now we'll go to Marie. All right, Marie, you're on.
Hi, interested in how much glucose is used in a PET scan, and the reason is that someone in my family has cancer and has been told, we know that glucose feeds the cancers, and he's afraid of taking a second PET scan too soon, even though he's going to be changing to oncologists as he goes for newer treatments. So I'd like to know about the type amount of glucose that he's exposed to in every PET scan, if that varies or if it's the same, and if there's too many in one time frame and what that time frame might be.
Yeah, so the glucose is sort of the form of glucose that's used in PET scanning is a radioactive form, and it has a short half-life, meaning that in a few days usually it's out of your system. But the important thing with those tests is that people, and we always check their blood glucose level, because if somebody has a high blood glucose level, when they get injected with the glucose, it's not going to go to the cancer cells that we want to see, because there's so much glucose in the blood that they're fighting for those same cells. So that's why it's important. That's why they say to avoid glucose before the scan, because you want your blood glucose to be relatively low so that when you do get injected with the form of glucose that we're giving you, it's able to sense that, okay, this is the glucose, the cancer cells take it up, and we can see it and give a really good accurate diagnosis for you.
Now, what if you were diabetic?
oftentimes there is a diabetic patient that we're dealing with, and so we check the blood glucose beforehand. We have to make sure that the levels are okay. If they're not, they have to either be rescheduled or we have to change around their insulin so that they can have the exam.
Interesting.
So how many can he have?
I'm sorry, what's that?
How many?
How many can he have that without any danger?
You know, it's there is no real set number to answer that question. I mean, people have multiple PET CTs as follow up to look for things, so it's not uncommon to have many.
I see.
Okay, thank you very much. So, Doc, where are we going? In other words, you know, it's extraordinary what we have seen develop. What can we expect in the next 20 years?
Yeah, I think the next 20 years has a lot of implications in terms of the imaging field. I think you're going to see a lot more molecular imaging, sort of like a PET CT, where nanotechnology or other sorts of forms of that sort of technology can create some sort of substance which attaches to a certain chemical in that tumor cell that you're looking for. Mm-hmm. You inject that patient with it, and then it goes to that area. So you might see things that are microscopic that you wouldn't normally see with today's imaging tests.
So how often does a guy like you have to sort of re-up on the new technology?
It's constant. It's one of the things that I love about the field is that it's always changing. Our professional, registrations, they require that we continually perform medical education and recertification and conferences and that sort of thing to keep up with the latest advances in technology and new things that are coming out.
Now, obviously, each hospital has to try to get the latest in technology. Otherwise, why would you go there? So there are some places, maybe Columbia Presbyterian or NYU, that may have more advanced machines than some of the upstate hospitals. How important is for us to know that?
It is and it isn't important. Really, one of the most important things is to have somebody who is really well-trained and interested in providing a great imaging study. And that goes not just to the doctor, like myself, as a radiologist who's going to be interpreting the imaging, but also the technologists that are there to help acquire the imaging. You need to have good equipment to give you a good enough image, but you also have to have the right protocol. You have to have the right people there who know this is how much contrast you need. It's really a team approach which helps to create that good imaging study. And of course, you need a physician who actually knows what they're looking for to interpret the study accurately.
So, but what if you really don't have, you discover, I wish I had a, thing. Would you say, okay, we've got to send this patient somewhere else?
Yes. Oftentimes, if there is something that, they're looking for that just isn't available, then they just need to get sent somewhere that deals with something like that.
And should the referring physician know that? In other words, should the referring physician know that it's going to be a complicated one, or is that beyond their station?
I don't expect them to really understand that for the most part. And it's one of those things that in that rare instance where I feel like we can't help them at a certain hospital that I'm at, they need to go somewhere else. We always have that, communication over the phone or in person to try to say, if you're looking for this, I really don't know, even if they have this, that we're going to be able to see it here. They really need to go somewhere where they do this all the time and look for this, and they have this kind of machine or what have you to look for that.
Interesting. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think we're about out of time. I want to thank everyone, all of you, who called in with these great questions. Don't you think, John?
Yeah. That was great.
Yeah. And I'd also like to thank Dr. John Mastrangelo for joining us today. Thanks for joining us, everybody, on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Kimball Lipscomb. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. Did a terrific job. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.